Good afternoon. Judge Phipps, are you hearing us okay?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Our first case this afternoon is Toro versus Asau, number 24-2434. We'll hear first from Mr. Perla.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juan Perla of Curtis Malley Approval for Appellant Mr. Toro. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Sure.
And may it please this court. I want to start directly with the court's focus order, because I think it focuses the discussion on the relevant question of whether the Administrative Remedies Program, or ARP, was practically unavailable for Mr. Toro in this case. The testimony identified at JA 944 in the focus order raises a material question of fact requiring vacator and remand for further review of the record and fact-finding on this question. Though I believe that it can also be resolved and should be resolved by this court as a matter of law in favor of Mr. Toro. And I'd like to make 3 points to go through those issues. First, Mr. Toro's testimony at JA 944 is not so clear as it might appear in isolation when it's viewed in the totality of the record. His answer was not directed at a specific question about whether he filed administrative remedies in solitary confinement right after the incident or his visit to the emergency department. It was in response to a broader question about whether he had filed remedies in 2020, long after the incident had occurred. And when you read the exchange, it's unclear, or it's clear that there's some confusion between the attorney who's asking him the question and Mr. Toro as to the timing of when these events are supposed to be happening. So I think it's confusing when you look just at that exchange, but that's not the only thing that creates confusion, because Mr. Toro elsewhere in the record, in his testimony, he testified that while he's in solitary confinement, he's disoriented in terms of time. There's a lot of testimony, for example, at JA 943, JA 857, 980 to 82, multiple times where he confuses the day, he confuses the events, and he says that it's disorienting to be in solitary confinement. So it's possible that Mr. Toro was not specifically making an admission about what he had done or not done in terms of administrative remedies in solitary confinement. It conflicts with other parts of the testimony, corroborated by one of the defendants, Mr. Moore, that Mr. Toro was not able to communicate with the outside world of his own accord, at least during those first few days that he was in solitary after the emergency department visit. He said that he couldn't get pen and paper, that he couldn't make phone calls, and Mr. Moore corroborates that when you're in solitary confinement, unless you have a scheduled court appearance, you don't get to make a call even to your attorney. So there is conflicting evidence that would raise questions of material fact that on a summary judgment motion would have to be reviewed and determined by a fact finder.
So counsel, thank you for all of that. And of course that might be right if this question were the only outcome determinative question for us, but I'd like you to speak more to the threshold question and explain please here in light of the Supreme Court's precedent in Egbert versus Boulay about the inappropriateness of federal courts creating or providing remedies in this constitutional context, unless it's directly following from on point Supreme Court precedent. So could you just explain for us your argument here about how there's an underlying Bivens claim, like the three that the Supreme Court has found to be legitimate in the past, because Egbert, I mean, pretty clearly indicates the Supreme Court's real hesitance with ever providing this kind of constitutional relief.
Well, Egbert itself, Your Honor, talks about how it's not dispensing with Bivens altogether. So something in the Bivens context survives Egbert, which is consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Abbasi, and most importantly, consistent with this court's recent decision in Muniz. Muniz made clear that Bivens survives in limited context. And like Muniz, all the other factors identified in Abbasi that were reaffirmed by Egbert are pretty much on all fours. There is no meaningful difference, and the government really hasn't pointed to any other than this notion of administrative remedies being available to Mr. Toro.
But I think, but if, So I'd like you then to walk me through the affirmative case, because as you know, of course, Bivens and Egbert are Fourth Amendment cases. Here we've got an Eighth Amendment claim. So I'd like, could you please articulate for us precisely where you see Supreme Court case law having created the precise claim and relief that you all are requesting here for this particular cruel and unusual punishment claim based on the prisoner-on-prisoner abuse?
Well, Your Honor, we're not here on a claim of prisoner-on-prisoner abuse. We're here on a failure to provide adequate, competent medical care under Carlson. And that would be the relevant precedent. Those are three decisions of the Supreme Court that have been affirmed by the Supreme Court, including in Egbert, as still providing a viable basis to bringing a Bivens claim.
So walk us through Carlson and the facts there, please, and then describe those in comparison with the facts here, if you would, for us.
Sure. So if we're going through the Abbasi factors, we have here the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, as the basis for the relief. We also have in Carlson an emergency situation where the inmate is suffering from an asthma attack, and the prison officials, including medical staff, do not provide him with the appropriate medical care that is needed to address that situation.
Life-threatening in the moment. Situation in that case.
It was a life-threatening situation because of the asthma attack. That's right. Correct. And they tried to plug him to a respirator that doesn't work. They gave him medications that were contraindicated. So they offered some treatment, but they didn't do what was critical to do in that emergent situation, which was transport him to the medical facility that would have been able to address that problem so that he didn't face the fate that he ended up facing, which is dying. And we have here exactly the
same
situation.
Is it death?
Well, if we look at it through the lens of Mooney's, we certainly have it, because in Mooney's, it was a diabetes situation, which was not life-threatening. And this court in Mooney's said, you don't need a life-threatening situation. And a change in severity or degree of difference in the amount of care that one needs is not a meaningful difference. So we do have on all fours in terms of an emergent situation that is life-threatening. There is evidence in the record that Mr. Toro was facing a life-threatening injury that could have caused serious infection, that could have caused suffocation, because he wasn't given the right antibiotics and pain medications that would have addressed at least the risk of infection and the swelling. With every time he swallowed, he was at risk of suffocating. And that's because he was in solitary confinement and not in a proper medical facility. And the critical issue is that Mr. Toro, just like Mr. Carlson, was not transported to the procedure that he needed to prevent this life-threatening situation by the time that it had been prescribed. Here,
I mean, it's certainly the case that because of the really serious injuries inflicted by the other prisoners, that there were, you know, serious conditions here. But in comparing it to Carlson, and again, this is just because we're talking about this particular kind of relief. The other thing the district court mentioned is not just the ARP possibility, but federal injunctive relief, if things have been properly litigated under or had been litigated under the Federal Tort Claims Act. So this case is not about whether there should be generally some kind of relief for your client, but whether this particular Bivens context and analogizing to Carlson is close enough on point with the really strict instructions the Supreme Court's given us in 2022 to not extend Bivens relief. So, I mean, did your client, as I understand it, did receive a lot of treatment?
Well, I don't know about a lot of treatment, Your Honor, but he did.
Surgery?
Ultimately.
Yeah.
But that, again, life-threatening and actually dying from the incident is not a requirement to make it meaningfully the same as Carlson. That's what this court has said repeatedly, like other circuits, most recently in the binding decision in Mooney's. So that issue, all those arguments were made in Mooney's, and this court rejected them and said, you don't need to die. You don't need to even be in a life-threatening situation. What you need is to have a serious medical need that has been disregarded that causes a flare-up.
But he received treatment, though, your client.
He did, and that might be relevant at the merit stage. The Ninth Circuit in Watanabe made sure to distinguish between whether different circumstances create a new context versus whether he actually has a claim on the merits that can be proven. So at the appropriate stages in the proceeding, these issues of whether he got the surgery, whether the care was adequate or not, ultimately might be relevant to a merits determination, but they don't come into play now in deciding whether there's a new Bivens context. And not even the government really presses that point, because I think that I think we understand that we're here on whether the remedies, were practically unavailable, which is the path that Moonies left open for these sorts of claims under Carlson. And on that point, I'd like to make another, before I run out of time, I'd like to make the point that the supposed grievance that he filed in the administrative, in the solitary confinement is not in the record, which begs the question, what happened to it? Was it torn up and thrown in the round file? These are all questions of fact that have to be investigated and explored on remand by a fact finder to determine whether or not these remedies were practically unavailable.
If I could just add, I took your point to be saying we're here just on the remedies, but if I may, I mean, if one rereads the Supreme Court's opinion in Egbert and just thinks about contours of the cause of action here, which, as you pointed out, is really failure to receive adequate treatment, it's really important for us to crystallize precisely what inadequate treatment is being claimed and whether that's sufficiently on fours, I think, with the inadequate treatment in Carlson, which is why I pressed you on it. So your point, your contention would be that the surgery did not happen quickly enough, soon enough after the injuries, and was not adequately performed?
I'm not talking about whether the surgery itself was adequately performed, but what makes this meaningfully, it's sort of a double negative, not meaningfully different from Carlson, is that there was an emergent situation that required a particular course of action that was prescribed to doctors, that was not followed by the prison officials and medical staff, and that there was a delay in getting the medical care that was required to address that emergent situation by a failure to transport the inmate to the appropriate medical facility, in both cases here, outside medical providers, which caused flare-ups and could have, in the case of Mr. Carlson, certainly happened. He died, and that was unfortunate. The case of Mr. Toro, he could have died. Every day after March 12th, Monday, after he went to the emergency department, is a day that Mr. Toro's life was in serious jeopardy. Both Dr. Focarole, the oral surgeon, the independent expert provided by Mr. Toro, Dr. Friedman, both concurred that this is a procedure that has to happen at most within 3 to 4 days of the injury. And Dr. Focarole said, I want him here at least 2 days from now, after being seen at the emergency department on Friday, which puts the surgery on the 12th. And by the grace of God, he didn't die every day after that, but he waited for more than 2 weeks to get a surgery that all the evidence suggests should have occurred within that 3 to 4 day period. I see we've lost Judge Phipps.
Do you have anything?
I think we lost him.
Thank you, Rob. Am I here?
Come on,
okay.
Judge Phipps, just hold on one moment. Judge Mascot and I can see you, but the arguing counsel cannot right now. Okay. We'll just take a pause for a minute. Okay, let's go back on the record. Mr. Carla, come back up. Your time for your principal argument had expired, but Judge Phipps might have some questions before you sit down.
Okay.
So we'll resume there. Judge Phipps?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Judge Freeman. Counsel, thank you so much also for your patience. I think my question just goes to this notion of what constitutes a new Bivens context. And it seems that there was no ARP in Carlson, but there is an ARP here. Isn't that in itself a different context?
Under this court's decision in Moonies, it is, but the court also said that whether it's practically unavailable would be a relevant consideration in determining whether in fact it is a different context. And here where we have sufficient evidence to show that the remedies were practically unavailable, or at the very least to establish a question of material fact, it would not be enough just that the remedies existed. And that's consistent with the Supreme Court precedent in Abbasi and Egbert, certainly consistent with the exhaustion of remedies case law cited by this court with reference to Ross, in terms of whether the administrative remedies programs can be considered to be available or to exist if they're not actually accessible to the inmate.
So I'm sorry, if I could just parse your question, your answer a little bit. It sounds to me that it is a different context because there is an ARP in here, but not in Carlson. But then I think what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that because there's some evidence or at least disputed facts that it was unavailable here, that might be a special factor that should be considered when we look to the availability of a Bivens remedy here. Is that the alignment of the analysis, or have I misaligned that?
That's right, Judge Phipps, and that comes straight out of this court's decision in Muniz. This court in Muniz pointed that out and cited Ross, the Supreme Court's decision that deals with availability of remedies and whether they're practically available or not. And it makes perfect sense, because if you require exhaustion of remedies to bring a Bivens actions, but then Ross says that you don't have to exhaust remedies if they're practically unavailable, it would seem odd to then foreclose the Bivens action on the simple basis that the remedies exist. So you need to be able to have this exception for practically unavailable remedies. Otherwise, you'd be doing what the Supreme Court has said at least twice in Abbasi and then in Egbert, that it was not overruling Bivens and it was not overruling Carlson. So something has to survive. And if the existence alone were to be dispositive, then you have effectively overruled Carlson, which is what this court declined to do in Muniz, which is the binding precedent that we're operating under.
Thank you very much.
I mean, again, this is my last thing. If you could just respond to my question, because I'm looking right now specifically at Muniz and its first reference to its articulation of the claim in Carlson. And it describes it on page 261 of that opinion. Prison officials fail to provide medical attention in response to prisoners' asthma attack leading to death and constituting deliberate indifference to medical needs in contravention of the Eighth Amendment. That's the articulation of our court's articulation in Muniz of the Eighth Amendment version of Bivens claims that survives after Egbert.
Yes.
And already we've talked about several distinctions here, in addition to all of the fact-specific questions about how realistic it would be to get the ARP relief.
Well, there, under this court's decision in Muniz, there is no meaningful difference because it is the delay in care, that the delay in emergency care was that total deprivation or the total absence of competent care, the failure to provide the medical care. And Mr. Muniz got care, just like Mr. Carlson, except that Mr. Carlson died because he didn't get the full care he needed on time.
So where's the dividing line? Is it any, because you also earlier answering some of my questions articulated that the problem was that medical advice to get a particular kind of care by a particular date. Is it your contention that any prisoner claim that they did not get the precise type of care recommended by a doctor by that date is a survivable Bivens claim under Carlson and Egbert and Muniz?
If it satisfies the criteria set out by this court, Muniz, I think it does, in terms of having a serious medical need, had a particular course of action that needed to be followed, including a timely attention to that care that was then not fulfilled. In Muniz, it resulted in the amputation of Mr. Muniz's toe, but he did get care. He did survive. He did end up receiving some kind of treatment. So again, the Ninth Circuit in Watanabe, which this court cited significantly in Muniz, draws, I think, a helpful distinction as to those issues. Those go to the merits. Those go to whether or not Mr. Toro, like Mr. Muniz or Mr. Watanabe, actually had a claim on the merits. It doesn't go to differentiating meaningful differences between Carlson and these cases. So I think that's, Your Honor, where the focus should be in terms of what he got his care. Did it go far enough? Was it the right quality? Those are merits issues that can be decided and should be decided once we get past this Bivens threshold issue.
So your position is that this court should, or actually you believe the court has articulated in Muniz that there is an actual lawful constitutional Bivens claim anytime a prisoner claims an Eighth Amendment violation because there was a serious medical need, there was particular medical advice given by a particular date, and then by that date, that advice is not followed. And that constitutes a cognizable Bivens claim in this circuit. That's what I hear you saying.
I think broadly speaking, it is. But I would just, again, qualify with the statement that that level of fine tuning and cutting it and slicing it that thin is something that Moody's would not have endorsed.
I don't know what you mean by fine. What do you mean fine tuning? I'm saying I hear your argument to be saying all we're doing today is deciding if there's a cognizable Bivens claim. And then all of my questions about how serious was it, was the device closely enough followed, all the data, those are merits things. But that's a lot of litigation. And it's also potentially, depending on how one reads Egbert, in this circuit, recognizing a very broad class of potential Bivens claims that then have to be litigated. And so since we obviously are, you know, really concerned in making sure that we're following Supreme Court precedent, I just want to make sure I understand what you think Muniz is requiring in terms of recognizable Bivens claims.
I think it's, Your Honor, I follow your question, and I do think Muniz does narrow the world of cases in some way, particularly by putting the administrative remedies program requirement at step one.
Okay.
But but the variations of medical circumstances is what Muniz talks about, or the degree in differences between the medical procedure that was provided or the specific medical need, maybe the cause of the injury. Those are things that don't differentiate a claim under Bivens from Carlson. If you have the broad strokes of the claim, of the circumstances being, I think, fairly the way that you described them, Judge Mascot, a failure to provide urgent medical care within the time allowed for in a life-threatening situation, for sure, even though it doesn't have to be. I think this fits within that world of claims, and it is a narrow world already.
Thanks, Mr. Barlett. We'll see you back on rebuttal. Ms. Lilly.
Thank you. Janie Lilly on behalf of the individual defendants. Your Honor, the district court correctly determined that there's no Bivens remedy available in these circumstances because of the meaningful differences between plaintiff's claim and the contact in Carlson. And I'd like to start with Judge Mascot's framing of the question, that principally plaintiff complains about the timing that it took for the Bureau of Prisons as an institution to come together to provide the type of care that is difficult to provide on the outside, much less when you're taking into account the difficult resource constraints and security concerns with providing external surgery and care. And that type of claim is just materially different in many different respects from the type of individual malfeasance in Carlson. And for those reasons, a Bivens remedy is not available. I'd also like to
wanted to pause there. On a separate point, in your letter, it sounds like you've asked the Supreme Court to recognize that Bivens relief is practically speaking, not available because of the mere existence of the ARP program. And what about a situation where someone is, you know, grievously injured or you know, deathly ill, and because of that incapacitation is unable to avail themselves of ARP?
Your Honor, in those circumstances, injunctive relief is available. The ARP does take into account emergency situations. That is the way that the executive branch has organized the provision of care, even in emergency situations. So in those situations, the answer is, of course, to pursue emergency care through BOP, to file claims for injunctive relief. What's not available in circumstances like plaintiffs here is that to sue the individual doctors, the dentist who saw him, the corrections officers who were visiting him the day after his assault, the warden, in individual damages for claims related to the systemic provision of medical care to the entire BOP population.
How though, practically speaking, would it work for someone who is having a fatal asthma attack to sue injunctive relief or the other emergency relief that the ARP contemplates?
Well, the again, that's a very different situation than what's at issue here. But in those circumstances, there are Bureau of Prisons program statement cited in our brief that contemplate how prisoners are provided with emergency medical care and can pursue emergency medical care. But again, here, what we're talking about is an act after the fact damages remedy against individual corrections officers and medical providers within the system, challenging what is in fact a systemic provision of medical care in this circumstances and in circumstances like it. And that's very different from the situation in Carlson that was challenging individual malfeasance by individual practitioners. And for those reasons, it presents meaningful differences in terms of the separation of powers concerns in recognizing the damages remedy here than in Carlson itself.
The carve out that we recognized in Mooney's that if notwithstanding the ARP's existence, relief were unavailable to inmates. If there were disputes of material fact as to whether relief was available to a particular inmate who is pursuing Bivens relief, would it be appropriate to have a fact finder resolve those before the district court can decide if Bivens relief is available?
Your Honor, as we noted in our brief, we think that any sort of inquiry into the practical availability conflicts with Supreme Court precedent, but taking Muniz on its face, we think that the types of questions about thwarting inmate access to the ARP that this court gestured to are just simply not present here. So the court doesn't need to dive into the only allegations in plaintiff's briefing here are that because he was in segregated housing, the ARP was practically unavailable to him. And we know that that's not the case, that inmates in the SHU, inmates who are experiencing urgent medical conditions, inmates who would like surgery on the outside, you know, in accordance with their preferred schedule, have access to the administrative remedy program, and that there's simply no allegations of thwarting of the type that the Supreme Court has recognized as a reason for excusing exhaustion of administrative remedies under the PLRA.
It seems that in Mooney's that we say, for example, should prison administrators thwart inmates from taking advantage of the ARP, right? And so we've left like an open universe of other examples that could satisfy this carve out, right?
Your Honor, I'm unaware of under this court's case law or other case law that merely being present, being in segregated housing or experiencing a medical issue of the type that plaintiff was experiencing is a reason for excusing exhaustion of the administrative remedies under the PLRA. The types of showings that the Supreme Court has said would excuse exhaustion in those circumstances are, you know, an administrative remedy program is merely a dead end. It's the inmate was actively thwarted from accessing the administrative remedy, not the types of allegations that we have here. So we do not think that there is the type of material dispute of fact that Your Honor alluded to that would give rise to an exception under Muniz.
I think Judge Phipps is coming on.
Yeah. Thank you very much. You know, I'm interested in your thoughts on the role of an ARP that's practically unavailable. I know in your briefs, you talk a lot about the presence of individual malfeasance in Carlson that you say is not here. And I'm wondering if those two have any connectivity in the sense of perhaps if the ARP was practically unavailable due to individual malfeasance, then maybe that would be an instance in which we get to the point that a Bivens action would still be actual, assuming that everything else lines up. But in the absence of individual malfeasance, would that still exist? And so maybe I'm saying, are you willing to perhaps concede that if there was practical unavailability due to malfeasance, that there would be a Bivens action even in the presence of an ARP?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the individual malfeasance discussed in our brief and characterizing Carlson is the type of medical malfeasance at issue in that case. I think in Muniz, this court describes prison officials thwarting an inmate's access to the administrative remedy program, and that sort of thwarting, which I guess could be characterized as malfeasance, would still permit a Bivens remedy to obtain in certain circumstances. So I think that there is some similarity, but I think our arguments are that this is, even putting aside Muniz, that this type of claim is so fundamentally different from the type of claim that the court considered in Carlson, that it presents a new context because of those significant meaningful differences. This isn't the type of individual malfeasance where contraindicated medicine was given that exacerbated a condition. Instead, plaintiff claims that BOP didn't act quickly enough, that it couldn't arrange an outside provider before the outside provider it had contracted with had gone on vacation, a pre-scheduled vacation, that BOP could not organize outside transport and security for plaintiff within the timeframe that he would have liked and that the outside doctor recommended before he went on vacation, and that fundamentally implicates systemic concerns at the Bureau of Prisons, and that any claim about delay in treatment is one that's a claim against the institution of the Bureau of Prisons, that it's dissatisfaction with the way the system functions, not a claim against the individual providers who were working to come together to provide him with treatment. If there are no further questions.
I do have a couple questions. Thank you. So in Muniz, since we're just talking a lot about that case, there's reference to deliberate indifference when we're trying to draw connections to Carlson. And there's also a reference to the defendants in Muniz and Carlson both operating as BOP medical staff. Is it the government's position that there has to be a deliberate indifference claim and the defendants have to be BOP medical staff or to be on all fours with Carlson? Can it be broader? Should it be narrower? I'd like you to speak a little bit more to what kind of Bivens claims you think are preserved after Carlson.
After Carlson. The Supreme Court in Carlson recognized what we've characterized as a Bivens claim, a claim for damages against individual doctors and BOP personnel in their individual capacity for the types of extreme malfeasance that violated clear standards in Carlson. And the Supreme Court has recognized that meaningful differences from that are the intrusion, the separation of powers implications associated with a different type of intrusion into executive branch operations, which we think is meaningfully present here. A different type of the specificity of guidance here, the notion that there is legal guidance about how the Bureau of Prisons should have come together to arrange for external surgery on a particular timeline is materially different from the type of guidance that was available to the Bureau of Prisons officials at issue in Carlson. So sort of all the way down, this is a very different type of claim than in Carlson that really implicates systemic concerns on behalf of the Bureau of Prisons, not the types of individual choices and malfeasance at issue in Carlson.
There doesn't have to be any particular intent claim, malintent.
Your Honor, not at the, I don't think the Supreme Court has drawn that line at the question of the new context inquiry about whether, you know, the court can extend a Bivens remedy into this new context or whether that's reserved to the legislature. But presumably the sort of the level of malfeasance and the clarity of the guidance available to prison officials would go a bit to Your Honor's question.
Thank you.
Judge Phipps, anything further?
No, I don't think so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Long.
Thank you.
I'd like to pick up on Judge Freeman, your question about what happens in a situation where an inmate is so incapacitated medically that they just have absolutely no way to access the existing remedies. And I think that's the extreme position, but that's why Moonies leaves open this possibility, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Ross, as well as Abbasi, Egbert, where they conceive of accessible, fully accessible, available remedies as being what would transform this into a new context. And when you look at Ross, dead end, thwarting, we have that, we have evidence of that in the record. We have Mr. Muniz, who talked about how after being discharged at the hospital, the nurse reassured him that he'd be back by Monday to get his emergency surgery. And one of the prison officials laughed and said, "You're not coming back Monday." I think it suggests potential machination. When he was brought back to solitary confinement and he was asking about when his surgery would happen, he was getting unclear answers. They would tell him it's coming, but they wouldn't tell him when. They wouldn't tell him whether it was being done on an emergency basis or not. So Mr. Muniz did not have the information he needed in order to know that he even had to apply for an administrative remedy, because he may have gotten the surgery on the 12th. And it wasn't until the surgery didn't happen that day that it became apparent that maybe something was not going to be done for him. And at that point, it was too late. And there's machination there, potentially misleading, as the Supreme Court said in Ross. There is, most importantly, the record is devoid of the supposed remedy that Mr. Toro may have filed. And I think that's a significant problem, because the burden is on the government to come forward to show exhaustion of remedy. So if this remedy existed, if this grievance existed, they would have submitted it into the record, but it's not here. So either it wasn't filed because Mr. Toro was correct that he wasn't able to practically get the tools that he needed to do that, or it was filed and potentially disposed of. It's a mystery. Again, it's like a dead end. There is a lot of evidence here to, at least at the summary judgment stage, where you have to draw all the reasonable inferences in favor of Mr. Toro to say there's a question of fact. We're going to vacate. We're going to remand under Moonies. That is what is required in order to investigate whether the remedies were practically unavailable or not. The same goes for the idea of an injunctive relief. It's no different from the administrative remedies. If he's not able to access it, practically speaking, it's not a remedy that exists in a way that creates a meaningful difference and creates a new context. Your Honors, I think I will rest there unless there are any other questions.
Thank you for your presentation. Just by way of baseline, do you agree that there's generally not an Eighth Amendment claim for medical malpractice in prisons?
I think it's a, I don't know that that question, not to resist the question, Your Honor, but I think that it mixes two different concepts. You're right that what we're dealing here with is not a claim of medical malpractice, because we're not here under state law, but we're here on a constitutional claim under the Eighth Amendment. And maybe there's some overlap in terms of the inadequacy of the care provided to violate the Eighth Amendment and what might happen in a medical malpractice claim, but they're not coextensive perfectly.
No, I think that's right. And I can just sharpen the question by saying usually medical malpractice is governed by a negligence standard. And so at least when we sit there and say negligence suffices for a med mal claim, we can also say that negligence, I think, doesn't suffice for an Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment claim about access to medical care. Do you think that's right? Do you think that's after reading the case law?
I would say that it's right, because the standard we're looking at is deliberate indifference. That would be the equivalent of the negligence standard in an ordinary medical malpractice claim. So for the constitutional claim, you have to show more than just negligence. You have to show deliberate indifference, which the district court here concluded had been at least sufficiently alleged at the motion to dismiss stage. And there's certainly enough evidence here for a fact finder to grapple with as to whether these defendants acted with deliberate indifference.
No, I, I, I figured that you would say that. I guess all I'm getting at then, though, is that one of the things that I think we could say is safely out of the question is that there we aren't going to recognize a Bivens claim based on medical malpractice tied to a negligence mental state. We know that that's just off the table, right?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I would just caveat to say that that's not what we're dealing with here.
No, 100%, 100%. But at one level, it can bring into greater focus exactly what we're dealing with here if we say, well, it's not that. That's not going to get you anywhere. And you've got to show that it's not that.
That's right, Your Honor.
All right. That's all I had. That helped me a little bit. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, since we're just to follow up then on my colleague's question, so how would you articulate then for us the delta between the bare negligence med mal that should not be recognized under Bivens and Carlson and the deliberate indifference that would be?
I think the guiding principle here is the situations that we had in Carlson and, for example, Moody's, Watabe, these other cases where other circuits have looked at and said the prison officials or defendants knew, understood the gravity of the situation, were aware of it, and nevertheless failed to act. They did not step in to prevent what here could have been a very tragic, fatal outcome, which is what happened in Carlson. So there has to be knowledge of the situation and the gravity of it.
And counsel on the other side keeps making a distinction or bringing a fine point to this whole idea of the institution. And I think the government's institutional concerns about whether, when we're talking about the contours of these constitutional claims, restrain into executive branch prison administration here on the bench. So when we're talking about knowing the gravity and nevertheless failing to act, I assume then we have to have a match between, like, even in your position would be the precise defendant you're suing needs to understand the gravity and themselves have had some kind of power to act and bring about the relief and then didn't. And so I'm not sure. I mean, so then that would raise questions, I guess, if it's like external to the prison. I mean, but there would have to be allegations that person, I mean, is there like, but for causation, is it proximate causation? Like, what's the connection have to be between their deliberate indifference, their knowledge of the gravity, and not fixing it?
Before I answer the question, I would just say that, again, these would all be for the merits, not for whether a new
context has been created. Well, I guess maybe. I mean, I disagree. That's not my reading. I don't think so far of Egbert. I mean, I'm open to you explaining to me why not. But I see Egbert as basically saying that the Supreme Court doesn't want courts or itself to be sort of freewheeling or litigants on the articulation of this precise limited area of relief, constitutional claims that are not textually granted in any statute by Congress. So we have to find like an analog. So you're saying it's about the merits, and I'm saying I'm actually really concerned in following Supreme Court precedent that I understand how it fits into Carlson. So if we're saying in response to Judge Phipps that we're not saying negligence mens mal comes in under Bivens, but it's deliberate indifference, I'm just curious about how we would know which defendants can be named in a cognizable Bivens claim under the Eighth Amendment and whether there has to be any connection between the gravity and failure to act, because that all would have to be part of the elements, I think, of the claim being alleged, right?
That's right, Your Honor. They would have to be elements of the merits of the claim, but they're not. I think that the sort of confusion might come from the notion of a, quote, Bivens claim. The Bivens claim is whether there's a money damage as cause of action available for a claim that has elements that have to be proven. So for there to be a new context for Bivens, to make a money damages remedy available, you have to fit into the world of circumstances that Carlson laid out. And we have that here for the same reasons that Muniz concluded that the six Abbasi factors in Muniz were not meaningfully different and focused only on the ARP.
The whole game here is the level of generality, which is why I'm pressing you on it, because you're correct. But then there's all, as you know, if you articulate claims for somebody in a complaint, like you have to know which defendant to bring them against and what relief to request. So I'm simply making what it seems to me is like an obvious reading of Egbert, but maybe not, that like we have to know which of those are permissible and fit in with Bivens. I'm not talking right now about proving it. I'm actually saying which articulation of a defendant and a remedy in a complaint is permissible as a constitutional matter under Carlson and Egbert.
I get your question. Thank you, Judge Mascot. That question would be answered by who the defendants were in Carlson, not by whether you have alleged deliberate indifference as to a particular defendant. It's the class of defendants that existed in Carlson. So the medical officials, the regional medical director, the frontline prison officials and staff. That's why, for example, in Malesko, the Supreme Court said, if you're going after private prison, that's a different class of defendants because you weren't dealing with a class of private prison officials in Carlson. But it doesn't tie to whether or not those individuals manifested deliberate indifference or not. That would be, again, an issue for whether the elements of the claim have been proven.
So then just one final question. So actually the real answer to Judge Phipps is that yes, like you can under Carlson bring general med mal like allegations, and it's going to be up to evaluation on the merits whether the plaintiff can show deliberate indifference, but they all come in because we don't really know in advance until we get to the merits. So we have to hear this court, the district court, we'd all hear these cases and they would prevail only if deliberate indifference is shown, but the allegation of negligence is adequate to bring it under Carlson.
No, the allegation, you would have to allege deliberate indifference. It would not be enough to allege negligence for a medical malpractice claim and then survive the circumstances of Carlson.
And then I promise, I guess I'm just saying then, it just still then raises the question, deliberate indifference by whom? Because I hear opposing counsel saying the practical realities on the ground, like at the BOP is, like who's responsible, who's in charge, who is being sued if there's multiple steps in the system? Because we have a prisoner who's being harmed like within prison walls, and then there's complicated medical care that requires like the working together of many different actors. So at the end of the day, like if there's just some general mismatch between the ideal care the prisoner gets and what he actually got, you all are trying to bring claims against particular people. And I think the government is asking, and I'm asking how we know who those claims can be brought against for what kind of relief. And I feel like the answer that you're giving in response is if there's just some general mismatch that suggests general deliberate indifference, it comes in, which would still, I think, potentially permit a pretty broad class of claims to be raised under Carlson in the circuit.
I think there's two steps to what you're asking me. I'll try to take them at one at a time. The identity of who the defendant is would be one aspect of it.
Yeah.
What claim can be brought against the defendant might be a different aspect of it. So who you can sue under Carlson is defined by who were the defendants in Carlson and whether the new defendants are meaningfully different from that class of defendants. What you're suing them for would have to be deliberate indifference to serious medical needs. A complaint that said I'm bringing a medical malpractice negligence claim would not be a constitutional claim that would fit within the contours of what was happening in Carlson. So that would be out, not because you sued the wrong person for the wrong claim, but because you may have had the right person, but you didn't bring a constitutional claim. So it's not a Bivens cause of action.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to the counsel. This case is submitted.